Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. Have you ever wondered about the tree canopies in Charlotte? Or what sparked the rivalry between Charlotte and Raleigh? Vote for the question you'd like WFAE to answer in the next episode of the FAQ City podcast. Go to WFAE.org/FAQ City.
From 90.7, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's the local news roundup. And as we begin this morning, lawmakers in Raleigh are moving toward approving a $24 billion budget, and they're doing so in an amendment-light process that has stirred partisan passion on both sides. Charter schools in four Mecklenburg towns, a surprise bonus, and a big shift in local judicial districts are all in the mix in Raleigh. And in Charlotte, the city council is pushing for larger pay raises for police, but leaving the matter of finding the money up to the city manager. And we're going to take another look at the NFL and its national anthem policy, this time as a new Carolina Panther speaks out. Joining me today, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro.
Good morning.
And Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer.
Hello.
Nick Oxner of WBTV.
Happy first day of June.
Thank you. And Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and WCCB and numerous others.
Good morning.
Good morning. So let's start with the General Assembly and their two-week-old short session. Republicans and Democrats disagree not only about what's in the budget, but also how the budget is being steered through the House and Senate, which we discussed a little bit on this program a week ago. This week, Mickey Michaud, who is a Durham Democrat, put it in very stark and to some unsavory terms. So that the audio was a little bit unclear there, but he compared the he said today we have seen a rape of this budget. This week there was also a state lawmaker, Republican state lawmaker Holly Grange, who said that Mickey Michaud should apologize for using that language. So let's start there. Mary C. Curtis, are you surprised that we have not heard an apology yet in terms of the language he used?
No. We've seen in many discussions this week and continuing going back that people don't apologize. And it's really difficult to have a nuanced and even-handed conversation when you're arguing over the terms of it. We'll see what happens, but we've seen in culture as well that folks put their line down in the sand, and you know the argument he was making about Democrats not being able to weigh in on the budget or offer amendments kind of gets lost in the rhetoric.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Nick, you were up there this week. Does this instantly overshadow the larger point that Democrats are trying to make?
Well, yeah, look, you have a budget where Democrats want us to be talking about simply how the lack of any input from anyone with a D next to their name, right? That should be the headline from the Democrats' perspective. Instead, we're talking about a member of the House Democratic Caucus who said North Carolinians were being raped and compared North Carolina to North Korea. And what I think is more interesting is he made the initial comments. He gets quoted in the newspaper. The next day, the News and Observer says, do you want to walk any of that back? I'm paraphrasing here, of course. And he says, no, I'm going to double down. And then yesterday, Holly Grange from Wilmington stands up and demands an apology. Republican from Wilmington demands an apology. And he stands up on the House floor again and says, I will not apologize. And so he's now tripled down, which I think is astounding. Of course, you've heard silence of any kind, not really any support, but not any calls for an apology from Democrats who just probably are hoping this goes away. But here we are.
But here we are. And Doss Helms, one thing that is not going away is the divisive issue of education, which is where you come in. So you're not doing the dividing, but you're doing the chronicling of the dividing. So this budget includes teacher pay raises of 6.5% on average. And it also includes what you reported on this week. I believe you reported on this week, this obscure bonus for 35 CMS schools. So tell me a little bit about the bonus that was discovered, and also who's going to win this debate in terms of teacher pay, because we have a difference between the governor and Democrats and Republicans, and I don't mean in terms of Republicans obviously have the vote, but who's going to win the public side of that?
So we'll start with the simple part, and bonus is probably not the best word, because this is not pay that would go to teachers. This is a pool of money that would be available for teachers to propose classroom projects, like I want more bouncy balls for my kids to sit on, or I need a new set of novels, or at least I assume that's how it would work, because that's how donors choose works more or less. So this paragraph in this long budget said, we're going to allot $200,000 to this group called Donors Choose, with the stipulation that they can use it only for these schools. And it listed 35 schools, a lot in the north suburbs, a lot in the south suburbs, kind of a strip along the western edge. And one thing I will say is that teachers have become very mobilized and empowered as this whole Red for Ed movement has taken place, and they had their big march. So literally within an hour or so of the budget being released to the public, somebody had screenshotted that and said, what's up with this? And teachers were saying, this is such a weird random selection of schools. It can't possibly be anybody's district. But it turns out it is. It is the newly redrawn 41st District, which is why people are not familiar with it. Jeff Tart, the Republican from Cornelius, currently represents that district. He is facing a Democratic challenge, and this is viewed as a really competitive district. So this is clearly the fine old tradition of pork barrel allocations, you know, take something back to your district. But
it's a one-time
thing? And it's not clear. It's especially not clear now that Donors Choose has said that they don't want any part of this, but how this would be distributed. So it sort of seems like one of those things that seemed like a good idea when they thought of it, but was not thought through very well, because this is just not. Donors Choose is a long established group. You go online and you can look up what you might choose to donate to. I went in and looked just in Charlotte. There are right now a little over 300 classroom projects. I could sort them by the level of poverty, or by I want to give to an art project, or I want to give to an elementary school. But that's what it's all about. And if I only have $50 to give, I commit to one, my favorite project, and others come in. So it's a very effective sort of online marketing for private donors. They don't do state grant allotments, and they were not consulted on this. They apparently learned about it from Twitter, as many of us did. So this kind of, you know, teachers were taking offense at this. I was seeing people who are saying, my school's on that list, we might stand to get something, but this makes no sense. So, you know, it appears to be a political ploy. And so Donors Choose, after about 24 hours of getting flack about this, sent a statement saying that we cannot accept this funding unless it's changed to equitably support teachers and students throughout North Carolina. Basically, thanks, but no thanks.
Hey, I'll say this is a case, I think, of good intentions, sort of on the part of Jeff Tart. My colleague Dedrick Russell caught up with him in Raleigh on Wednesday and kind of said, what's up, dude? This is after Donors Choose came out and said they wouldn't accept the money. And he said, look, as I go around my district, teachers have said they want money for funding, so this is how I thought we could go and give money for funding. Okay, that's not a bad proposition, right, to help the teachers he's talked to in his district. But the curious thing to me is when Dedrick said, well, would you be open to giving the money to all of CMS? He said no, he'd rather it go to Robeson County or to somewhere in St. Louis or Mississippi and to other school districts that need it. So again, this is, as so often happens in the General Assembly, when there's little oversight and little thought going into something, a good idea maybe that had good intentions gone terribly, terribly awry.
Well, Charlie Jeter, I'm sorry, Mary, just real quick, I was going to share this quote that I think was in your story, Ann. Charlie Jeter, the the CMS lobbyist, who is a former state rep, said that this is, quote, the reelect Jeff Tart provision of the budget, which is an interesting description. Go ahead, Mary.
No, I was just going to say, in a time when everything has become so political, that it seems particularly cynical to folks when you feel that the needs of school children are also in play, whether that's intentional or not. And so I think that's why you really saw the pushback, because we're saying, really? Is there nothing that's not political?
I was going to ask Ann the second part of my very lengthy introductory question. So the 6.5% pay raise, let's assume that goes through. Democrats have been jumping up and down saying it should be larger, including the governor. My question is whether you think that issue resonates. In other words, do voters sort out that it was only 6.5% versus a higher percentage?
Well, first of all, I can tell you there are teachers who are cringing when you say 6.5%, because it is an average of 6.5%, but that varies by where you fall on the pay scale. And especially the veteran teachers, the legislature did revise this to provide a small increase for the most senior teachers, I believe $70 a month or $700 a year for a 10-month schedule. But they're saying, if you look at all the things we've lost, the benefits that cost more, we've lost longevity pay, we're actually well behind where we were in 2008. So they take a lot of offense when people say 6.5% raise for teachers because they feel like that's being manipulated. You know, some obviously are getting more if some people are getting less. But, yeah, I mean, this whole process is about November. It's about how you can campaign. And there are literally already ads being prepared that for Democratic incumbents who vote against the budget saying Joe Blow voted against raises for teachers. Joe Blow voted against safer schools, because with the all or nothing vote, then anybody who opposes it can be labeled as being against the most popular parts of it. And conversely, if Democrats had been able to introduce amendments and say, you know, here's an amendment for a 10% across the board raise, and the Republican incumbents had voted against it, you can bet that would have showed up in those campaign ads as well.
Those are the words of Ann Doss Helms. When we come back, we're going to look at HB 514, which is the real fight, at least in this part of the state, in terms of education. You're listening to Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
You have a voice, but what if you felt like it wasn't being heard? She Says, WFAE's new investigative podcast, is available now. Hear the first episode on WFAE.org/She Says.
All right, back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is the Friday Local News Roundup. We have Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, and Ann Doss Helms of the Charlotte Observer. We were about to go into HB 514, but before we do, Nick, you mentioned to me that there are some important provisions in this budget regarding pay raises for state employees. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. While a lot of the focus has been on teacher raises, there have been the budget includes some significantly good news for other state employees in terms of pay raises. Everyone is set to get a 4% prison employees set to get 4% pay raises, other state employees set to get 2% pay raises. And the most significant thing is that this budget sets the minimum wage for state workers in North Carolina to roughly $15 an hour, which is a living wage. I don't know that anyone ever thought Republicans would pass a thing called a living wage. And yet they have. It actually won the support of the State Employees Association, traditionally not an ally of Republican leadership in Raleigh. This always comes with some caveats, but every state worker in North Carolina will make at least $15 an hour after this budget is passed.
So that's what's happening with the pay raises. On HB 514, which is a proposed law that was introduced by Mecklenburg Republican Bill Brawley, actually last session,
yes,
and now is coming to the fore this time around, it has been expanded. It would give four Mecklenburg towns, Huntersville, Cornelius, Matthews, and Mint Hill, the authority to start charter schools. Democrats have called this a catalyst for resegregation and criticized it heavily. So let's start, before we ask you, Ann, let's start with State Senator Joyce Waddell, who is a Mecklenburg Democrat. Here's what she had to say about HB 514.
We've tried so hard to have complete integrated schools. And what this is going to do is going to make segregation come back in many of our schools.
So that was Joyce Waddell. Now, Bill Brawley, the House Republican from Mecklenburg County, says that Democrats are up in arms for little reason.
We're talking about the possibility of one charter school in the town of Matthews, which will not pull all 6,000 students that are currently attending school in Matthews out of anything. So I don't see how it has the sweeping effects that people fear.
So, and what are you hearing? I mean, obviously CMS has been opposed to this, but what are you hearing from people in education about what this is going to do, assuming it's going to pass, which it looks like it will?
Yeah, and I think both sides have some truth to it. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools has been very dramatic in its opposition. Charlie Jeter, their governmental liaison, said, let's face it, these four towns have asked for a divorce. So
he had a good quote week this week.
He's always quotable. But they are viewing it as these towns have taken a stand that essentially cuts them off. And these are four small towns that are significantly more affluent and whiter than Mecklenburg County as a whole, and Charlotte in particular. So that's where the segregation part comes in. People like Bill Brawley are saying this does not make them open charters. There is, in fact, a pretty good chance that they certainly won't do it quickly. It's just an alternative. They already have Charlotte Mecklenburg schools. They already have regular charter schools, which are publicly funded public schools, they have private schools. This is just one more option, but it is a very different option because it is a type of public school that could be created and could tap into both state and county money, but could be restricted to, if demand is high enough, residents within the town. So this is a real twist on charter schools. And we have had some statewide groups, the School Boards Association and the North Carolina Association of School Administrators, showed up and said, we don't normally weigh in on local bills, but we agree that this is something that has major statewide implications and has not been significantly discussed or vetted. And I don't know if you want to get into the funding aspects of this, but that's where it, again, gave some real weight to some statewide implications.
I do in a minute, but I want to hear what Glenn Berkins has to say about this.
Well, I think Brawley's being a bit disingenuous. He's absolutely correct on the face of it. It does not require these towns to do it. In fact, as he correctly points out, it would not remove all 6,000 of Matthew's students. But rather than calling it a divorce, I think it's more of a trial separation. And during this period, you will see how well these towns will have an opportunity, Matthews in particular, to see how well this works. And it doesn't end here. CMS is being nibbled to death by ducks, or death by a thousand cuts, whichever overworn metaphor you want to use. And so, surely he understands that it doesn't end here, that this is just a trial period.
Yeah, and coming from a northern city, where you have the urban core and you have surrounding counties that really try to separate themselves from those school districts, and seeing how schools try to, through magnets and other programs, keep a mix of students, you have to say that there is a precedent for this kind of move, and that whatever the intention, that the result would likely result, if you are just looking at residents of these, as Ann points out, wider and more affluent towns, that it would be a separation, and you at least have to discuss that openly and honestly if we're going to go down that particular road.
Can I make one more point on this? Here's an interesting thing. So, the House Bill 514 passed the House last year, but the Senate decided not to take it up, effectively tabling it for last session. So here we are in the short session. The Senate officially passed it yesterday. The problem for people who want this to become reality right away is that in committee, they amended the bill in the Senate to include Huntersville and Cornelius after they said, hey, us too. Because they changed the language of the bill from what the House passed, the Senate voted on the changed version, passed that. So now it has to go back to the House to get voted on again. And it's interesting, a lot of folks who oppose this, the CMS, the Association of Schools lobbyists, they don't think that there are the votes in the House to pass this a second time. Now, of course, they're paid to think that. maybe Bill Brawley might think otherwise. I don't know. I haven't asked him yet. But all this being said, the fight over House Bill 514 is not over yet. And frankly, it's not over because they expanded the reach to include two more cities that wasn't really necessary.
Never a dull moment in the General Assembly. And there's something that's maybe equally or more, earth-shattering in education circles, which is the fact that aside from what happens to HB 514, the state budget, which is going to pass and may have passed since we've been on the air, I'm not sure, but they're talking
still
about
talking.
Yes, they're still
Twitter.
Okay. The state budget includes a provision that would allow cities to provide funding for schools. This is breaking a precedent that's, 80 years or so old in North Carolina. So let's start with the context here, and why is this such an important step?
So the original town charter bill that had just Matthews and Mint Hill, it contained all these elaborate descriptions of how the financing would work. And that became a big issue. CMS worked with Jerry Cohen, a longtime legislative bill drafting expert, and they said, here are all these problems. Here's why it won't work and or it'll be bad for taxpayers. And Bill Brawley said, thanks, we'll fix that. And they fixed it by pulling out all of the funding specifics out of this specific House Bill 514, which may or may not pass, and they put it in the budget, which certainly will pass. And this is huge, I think, that towns now have, they are not required to, but they have the option of using their town money to pay for public education. So And as people have pointed out, this is a big change that has received very little analysis or discussion. We don't know how it's going to play out. CMS came in and said, well, okay, now when the mayoral candidates talk about how they want this, that, and the other, maybe we go back to them and say, okay, maybe you pay for more janitors, or you hire more school resource officers, or, you know, it's the districts could get in on going to towns and asking for this, that, and the other. Charter schools could also do that because, again, charter schools are public schools. So say if you're in Huntersville and you think your schools are too crowded and you go to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools and they say it's going to take us a decade to build you a new school, then CMS might say, how about if you help us buy more mobiles? But then they might go to Lake Norman Charter School and say, well, what can you do for us? I mean, it's just this is going to ripple out across the state. And as we have already seen, when the state has primary responsibility but the county has significant funding responsibility, sometimes they end up doing a lot of finger-pointing back and forth over who should take the responsibility. Now we've got a lot of third parties in that. And then you look at these smaller rural counties, can their towns afford to do the kind of things that Charlotte might be able to do?
And I thought this was going to be a compromise that made House Bill 514 moot. I mean, because if you just look at what leaders in Matthews are saying, right, why they want House Bill 514, they said, oh, well, you know, we understand CMS just can't, they don't have the money to get around and build us more schools in our district, so we don't want our kids in trailers, and so that's why we want to build our own charter school that, you know, won't have trailers. Well, under this, if they wanted to contribute the money to CMS, they could. I thought it was actually, I mean, now we know there are other motives, right, when we talk about the taxing authority needed for towns to open a charter school, but I think it's interesting. You could just rely on this provision and tell a town like Matthews to put its money where its mouth is, literally, and give it to CMS to build classrooms in their area. That's not going to happen, but they could.
And you know, Mary, one thing that Ann said in her answer that immediately resonated with me is this idea of, you know, mayor's races. There's always this talk about, particularly former Mayor Roberts, but others have talked about education, how they're going to improve it. And that always blurs the lines, and people are always confused about who funds schools anyway. And this just sounds like a way to wreak more political havoc.
Not only will it make those kinds of distinctions, you know, as people are making campaign promises, and you'll say, well, how can they keep them if they don't fund it? But as Ann also pointed out, it will lead to more finger pointing for promises unkept. And the people who pay, of course, parents trying to figure out how to best educate their kids, the kids themselves. And so this has just become one more piece, one more part of a political football, and who loses?
Nick Oxner, you were in Raleigh this week, as I mentioned, and I did want to at least make a quick public notice of the proposed changes for Mecklenburg judges and how they would be elected. What are they talking about changing, and why is this upsetting to some?
Yeah, so they want to basically reduce the number of judges that are elected countywide, and they want to instill more districts. And it's going to, if this plan goes through, and who knows if it will, maybe it will, maybe it won't, more judges would be elected in districts, which essentially cuts down the number of voters. And this plan, if you look at it most ways, would basically ensure that you have probably the likelihood of more Republican or moderate judges being elected from a generally Democrat county like Mecklenburg, because it ferries out more influence to all of the suburbs around the county.
Nick's absolutely right. But I think we should not bypass that too quickly, especially in light of what former governor and former Mayor Pat McCrory said the other day. Mecklenburg County is effectively, in county races, African Americans hold the balance of power in Mecklenburg County right now. And this would undo this. It's like changing the rules, if you will. And we see that as not just Mecklenburg County, but as a nation. As this nation continues to become more brown, we are seeing efforts to change the rules, whether it's voting rules or how we are drawing districts. We're seeing a concerted effort of conservatives to try to find a way to hold on to that power as our demographics change. And this is just another example of that.
And many people would say, as you referenced Pat McCrory, that he just said out loud what a lot of people think.
Well, the Charlotte Observer has put that forward in an editorial.
By the way, for those who don't know, former Governor and Mayor Pat McCrory said, in essence, that the power had become too segregated in terms of the Black political caucus and their influence on elections. Go ahead, Glenn. I'm sorry.
Yes, I was saying that in response to what Mary said, even the Charlotte Observer in an editorial proposed that maybe it's time to move away from at-large seats and do more districts for balance, which actually shocked me. We're going to do with the rules change what they can't do at the polls. And I'm always suspicious when we start engineering to achieve a certain political objective.
It also sort of says that all of these candidates are alike, that people are monolithic, that, say, if you have a bunch of candidates who are African-American, that they aren't different in each way as people in their positions that they take. And so, as you say, Glenn, when you just say this block, that block, it really erases individuality.
That is Mary C. Curtis. We're on the Friday Local News Roundup. When we come back, we're going to get into the police pay raise that was discussed by City Council this week, and also more reaction this time locally from members of the Carolina Panthers to the NFL's never-ending national anthem policy woes. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks. We'll be right back after a quick fundraising break. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg. I'm in for Mike Collins, and this is the Local News Roundup. The panel today is Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary C. Curtis from WCCB and Roll Call, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer. We've talked a lot about the state budget. Let's talk a little bit about the city budget. So this started with the city manager proposing a 6.5%. What is it, about 6.5%, by the way? 6.5% average pay hike for CMPD. Since then, council members have said they want to do more, and of course, the police had asked for 15%. So let's start with Republican Councilman Tark Bakari. He had gone on a ride-along last week and emerged from that to say that there's just no way 6.5% would be enough. This week, he was talking about the manager's revised raises and saying that senior officers still would not be given enough.
Theoretically, these are some of our best officers. These are the ones that should be serving as a role model for some of the newer folks. So how do you tell them that this is, maybe it's not extraordinary, but how is it more than just status quo? How do you explain that to them?
And his fellow Republican on the council, Ed Driggs, who has been opposed to the proposed tax increase that is in Marcus Jones' budget, said that when it comes to police pay, the manager needs to do more.
I think the manager's been working very hard to come up with a solution that's responsive to the needs of the police department, and I'm very supportive of that effort. I think it would be beneficial for officers to have more benefits as well as more pay and make this a better working environment for them.
So, Glenn, we talked a little bit about this, about the ride-along and the public relations aspect of it last week. Any surprise to you in terms of how this conversation is going at the moment?
No surprise here. Beyond the work that the police department does, and we all know that it's inherently dangerous work, this is really this really boils down to market forces, market economies. We know that CMPD is having a very hard time attracting and retaining officers. And until they're able to address that, that's going to continue to happen. So in a lot of ways, markets determine what a pay rate should be for a certain job. When I don't think we would be having this conversation if we had candidates lined up to join the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. I think we would be having a slightly different conversation.
Now, at the same time this week, Councilmember LaWanna Mayfield, who has been under a lot of scrutiny for some of her recent Twitter posts, including one in March regarding social injustice, she said, quote, being black in America under number 45 has created homegrown terrorists wearing blue uniforms that has brought a lot of condemnation from a range of people, including obviously the police department. So this week there was a citizens forum. Some spouses of CMPD officers appeared and spoke to LaWanna Mayfield in the council. And the message was, our husbands are not terrorists. So Mary, help us sort this out. Where is this thing headed?
Well, again, this is one of those conversations that there is a conversation to be had, a serious one, about the relationship between police officers and the communities they cover, particularly communities of color. We've seen videos of police acting bravely and others of folks where they've questioned their reaction when they come across someone of color. And we've had those discussions, and not only that, but those clashes here in Charlotte, North Carolina. But by weighing into it with this tweet, the conversation quickly became get on one side or the other. And when police officers' wives show up to confront LaWanna Mayfield and say, listen, our husbands are brave and they're putting their lives on the line and we still want more pay and you need to appreciate this, she did walk it back somewhat, saying that she wasn't calling all police officers terrorists. But at this point, it's difficult to go along with that conversation that needs to definitely be had. We also, I saw some stories that said some of her constituents are saying, you know, we like that you speak up, because even though you sometimes don't articulate it in a way that it is the most productive, you're at least bringing this to the fore. But I tend to think that maybe it's stopping the conversation instead of starting it. And we know in Charlotte, North Carolina, that we will continue to have these kinds of confrontations in a way. So by not discussing it, it's just going to lead to more problems in the future. But we'll see how it will play out for her. She is an elected official, so eventually she has to face the voters.
Yeah, and she had a Twitter post this week that said, quote, to all of you talking nonsense about my posts, forget you. So, as you say, she's not backing down.
No, another case of no apology that we've seen. I think that's a theme of today.
It really is.
To get on one side or the other. And in all of those cases, as we've tried to delve into them, whether it's school funding, police pay, many others, there is a conversation to be had with input from both sides. But we are kind of cutting that off at this point. And, you know, that's unfortunate, because the losers will be the folks in those communities and police officers who also have to face that there is mistrust among some in the community that they will be treated fairly. So they have to hear that as well. It's not saying that everyone's a terrorist or all police are bad, but there is an anxiety for every traffic stop, for every time you call the police officer. And I think the fact that Charlotte police go out into the community and do other things, they realize that that's a problem as well.
And Ms. Mayfield may have never apologized, but she has said repeatedly she was never saying that all police are terrorists or that Charlotte police in particular are terrorists. She was responding to an incident of police brutality in another city, and she was saying that comment directed at the bad cops, essentially.
Yeah. And everyone's seen those videos.
Yeah.
So you can't unsee that, whether it's a Stephon Clark or the basketball player in
Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Bucks,
Sterling Brown, or others, or even here in North Carolina, let's face it, at the different stores.
In Charlotte, we've had certainly.
Yes, so that it's we ignore that at our peril.
And it's just kind of a sign that having really difficult, nuanced conversations via Twitter can be problematic.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know,
through that tweet and sort of trying to parse the grammar and the content and the logical connections, and it's not the best written sentence in American history.
Well,
I think most of us can say that for our social media posts.
And the issues are so intense, people will not give you the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
They're going to make the worst possible assumption, and that's when you get into trouble as well.
What makes it even a little more bizarre in a LaWanna Mayfield's brought this up herself, is, you know, she sent the tweet in March. It resurfaced, last week?
Yeah.
And caused the firestorm, you know, 2 months
that
after
That was a strange journey into controversy and political fighting that it took that long. I guess
every misstep will be weaponized.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of sides talking past one another, that brings me to the National Football League. So, and again, we got into this a little bit. The NFL owners introduced this new policy. Everyone must stand or stay in the locker room if they're not going to stand during the anthem. Obviously, this has been an issue with President Trump and pretty much everyone, it seems like, for the past couple of years, started with Colin Kaepernick out in San Francisco. So this week, Torrey Smith, who's one of the newest Carolina Panthers, spoke pretty passionately on this topic. And one of the things he said was that what began as a social justice process has been turned into, by critics, an anti-military gesture by the players. So, Glenn, I want to start with you. What did you think of what Torrey Smith had to say this week?
I think he was absolutely right on that particular point. And since we're talking about people who are not backing down and not apologizing, I said last week on the show that I thought this was a reasonable compromise. And so I'm going to double down like everyone else this week and say that again.
Glenn Birkins is not sorry. You're on the record.
Torrey Smith also said, at the end of the day, the league is about money. It's a business. And he's absolutely right about that. And businesses are not in the business of getting involved in cultural wars. We've seen that, whether it was with Roseanne, we've seen it with Starbucks, whatever. They want to make money. We cannot go into our employers' offices and take our politics and our beliefs into those places, no matter how good intentioned, no matter how just our cause. And if any of our readers doubt me, here's what I want them to do. Go home over the weekend, make a big political banner, and then hang it in your cubicle. If you're not fired Monday morning, you will be told to take it down. You cannot bring your politics to work. And the NFL is a work environment. I think this is a good compromise because the players are now allowed to stay in the locker room, which is something they weren't allowed to do before. They were allowed to stay in the locker room, I think, before maybe 2009. And then they were required to come out in what I believe is a forced act of patriotism. So if you don't feel like coming out, if you're not feeling particularly patriotic because there's been another police shooting, then stay in the locker room. I think it's a compromise, and I think it's a compromise we had to have.
That said, I think that most of us on our jobs aren't asked to come and salute the flag first thing, because we realize when the NFL made the decision to have these patriotic displays, that in itself was also a political statement and a financial one as well. And I think that when you make a compromise like this, it will not be the end of it, because we saw the president, and a lot of folks are saying the NFL owners did this because the president used this quite a bit. He then said, well, you know, if you don't stand for the anthem, you should leave the country. So I think that, of course, people will be noting who's in the locker room and who's not. This is going to continue. And in a week when we have seen, you know, Starbucks try to solve racism, or, you know, these other things coming out, the fact that the NFL would choose to do this when, let's face it, the protests were kind of dissipating on their own.
They basically reignited this firestorm.
Yes, yeah. So they were making a stand in itself. And because of the racial dynamics of the NFL, the owners being white, 70% of the players being African-American, that is also troubling. So it's a compromise that, in context, I think there's a lot more going on, and it will not be the end.
I wonder, Glenn, what do you think about there is an interesting situation with David Tepper coming in. He's been very publicly critical of President Trump. And there was concern by players last year that Jerry Richardson would come down hard on players if they protested. So would you expect any more or different type of protest from Panthers this year with a new owner as opposed to this past season?
It's hard to know. I don't think the new owner has as much to do about this as what happens out there in the world, police shootings, things like that. I think that will determine whether or not we see further actions. The other thing that I would point out very quickly is that these are wealthy men with very high profile positions in the United States. There are ways to make the point across other than kneeling during the pledge. Now, I don't care if they kneel during the pledge. That does not offend me.
Anthem,
I believe,
right.
During the anthem. I believe that's an act of patriotism just as much as saluting the flag. However, this doesn't have to, I mean, they can find other ways to keep this alive, to keep this movement alive, and that's what I would encourage them to do.
That's going to have to be the last word from Glenn Birkins. He's not apologizing, but he is with the Kew City Metro. And Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Mary C. Curtis, Roll Call and WCCB, and Nick Oxner from WBTV. Thank you all for being here this week on the Local News Roundup. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.